Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who looks at the declining approval rating of President Bush among Americans as seen in recent public opinion polls. David Glazer, national director of the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, who describes the transcontinental bus caravan being organized to raise awareness about the plight of immigrants, many of whom are subject to low pay and dangerous working conditions. And John Wilhelm, president of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union, who discusses his union's victory at Yale University and the wider significance for the labor movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports that Saudi Arabia, under renewed heat for its links to terrorists, is inquiring how to obtain a nuclear weapon. A strategy paper is circulating at the highest levels of the Saudi kingdom in Riyadh. It looks at three options: developing a nuclear program as a deterrent, forming an alliance with an existing nuclear power, and pushing for an agreement on a nuclear-free Middle East. It had been assumed that Saudi rulers were happy to enjoy the protection of the U.S. nuclear umbrella, but with the fallout from the 9/11 attacks and the alleged Saudi role in funding terrorists, the kingdom is looking for alternatives. According to United Nations officials and international arms experts, the Saudi leaders feel pressure from Iran, which has an active nuclear program, and Israel, which is thought to possess over 200 nuclear warheads. It has long been feared the oil-rich Saudi kingdom had nuclear ambitions. In 1988, they bought intermediate-range missiles from China that could put a nuclear warhead in any city in the Middle East. As one UN official concluded, regional insecurity tends to produce a quest for a nuclear umbrella. With the expanding war on terrorism and increasing casualties, the Pentagon is turning to the Latino population to play a larger military role. Senior Pentagon officials are calling Latinos the most promising ethnic group for recruitment because their numbers are growing so rapidly in the U.S., constituting a target population with large numbers of low-income men with few job or educational opportunities. The U.S. military is also reaching out to non-citizens with the promise from the Bush administration of immediate citizenship, bypassing the standard 5-year wait for a green card. There are more than 37,000 non-citizens, almost all Latinos, currently enlisted in the military service. Some recruiters have even gone into Mexico seeking candidates who may already have U.S. residency papers, angering Mexican authorities. According to Britain's independent newspaper, Pentagon officials hope to raise Latino numbers in the military from about 10% to 22%, a figure cited recently by John McLaurin, Deputy Secretary of the Army. Statistics from the Pew Hispanic Center, a nonpartisan think tank, show that Latinos are already doing dangerous combat jobs in disproportionate numbers. While they make up 9.4% of enlisted men and women, 17.7% of them handle weapons. The first casualty in the war in Iraq was a Latino non-citizen, a Guatemalan orphan named Jose Gutierrez, and other casualties have included many non-citizens and immigrants. During the Vietnam War era, the Pentagon singled out poor people for both the draft and deployment on the front lines, but this is the first time a specific ethnic group has been targeted for recruitment. Anti-war groups have denounced the Pentagon's strategy as exploitation of an impoverished group to carry out the combat duties of the U.S. war on terrorism. In the latest battle for health care reform, the state of Illinois is looking into buying lower-cost prescription drugs directly from Canada. The state is modeling its program after the initiative in Springfield, Illinois, which has enrolled 800 city employees in a voluntary plan that covers maintenance medications that are purchased directly from a Canadian wholesaler. Springfield Mayor Michael Albano predicts the city could save between $4 and $9 million if most city employees join the plan. Canadian pharmaceuticals can be as much as 80% cheaper than their American counterparts. The savings have drawn thousands of senior citizens and others seeking cheaper drugs to cross-border sales estimated to be worth $650 million a year. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is looking to halt the cross-border trade. The Justice Department has gotten an injunction against RX Depot, a chain of 85 storefront stores that imports medications directly from Canada. The Food and Drug Administration has sent undercover agents to expose the traffic in Canadian pharmaceutical drugs. The agency investigated the Springfield, Illinois program and claims that Mayor Michael Albano is allied with an illegal drug distributor. The mayor responded that the FDA conducted a sting operation on the wrong pharmacy. This week's news summary was compiled by Britta Brundage and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
As George W. Bush addressed the United Nations General Assembly September 23rd in an attempt to win support from skeptical governments from around the world for what has become a chaotic and bloody U.S. occupation of Iraq, the president was quickly losing political support at home. The combination of an anemic economy and continued instability both in Iraq and Afghanistan have contributed to a loss in confidence in the president as seen in recent public opinion polls. Several polls conducted in late September found that President Bush's approval rating had sunk to around 50%, his lowest standing since he took office after the disputed election of 2000. Support among Americans for the Bush administration's war in Iraq has also seen a precipitous drop, from a high in the over 60% range to a new low of 50%. Although many Democratic Party leaders had voted for a congressional resolution authorizing Mr. Bush's invasion of Iraq, some Democrats now running for the White House are openly attacking the president for misrepresenting the truth in making his case for a U.S. war. The growing concern among Americans about the weak economic recovery, coupled with the loss of nearly 3 million jobs since the president was sworn into office, has emboldened many Democrats' critique of the Republicans' foreign and domestic policies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who looks at the president's declining approval rating and the strength of the Democratic candidates now vying for their party's nomination.
If we had a media in the United States that actually reported on politics, everybody would know. But since we don't, we can reveal to your audience first and foremost that there's been a dramatic drop in the president's approval ratings and in, frankly, the public perception of him. If you remember that in the heart of the Iraq war, right as it started, and I'm not talking about whatever we call this thing now. I happen to call it a war. The president doesn't. But in the heart of the actual fighting, President Bush's approval ratings went up almost to his father's level. We're talking the very high 80s, low 90s. I mean, almost everybody was with him, supposedly. He is now down to approval ratings of around 50%, 51, 52, 53. So he's lost the better part of 40 points in a matter of 3 months. That is almost unheard of. Even Richard Nixon didn't drop as quickly as Bush has dropped. Now, I'm not going to suggest to you for a second that he's going to keep going and, you know, go through the floor. I think this is a very politically divided country. And there's a base of support for the president that is probably around 40%. But what's fascinating is the rapidity with which he has approached that base. And the reason for it is pretty clear. There has been, first off, a real turning of public sentiment as regards his handling of the Iraq war. For the first time, polling shows that more Americans feel he's blowing the war than doing it right. And that's the first time that since the start of the war that that's happened. Secondly, his personal credibility has gone through the floor. He is a president who came in and promised that he would restore honor and credibility to the White House. Today, more than 60% of Americans believe that he has been deceptive in his public pronouncements about the war. And the percentage of Americans who rank him as untrustworthy is now over 50%. So this is dramatic stuff, and it really is the sort of thing that people ought to stop for a second and, you know, just take this all in. It means that the approach to this president ought to be very different. It shouldn't ought to be that cautious sort of apologetic, soft criticism that you've heard from so many congressional Democrats. This is a guy who's on the ropes, and the smart politicians, and I will count Howard Dean and a few others in that camp, have recognized that. They're going after him, and far from, you know, going out to some strange, dangerous place politically, they're actually very close to where the center of gravity is in our politics.
It would be helpful if you would scan the announced candidates in the Democratic field vying for the nomination and how they variously have handled the whole notion of attacking the president or holding their fire, as some of the candidates had during the debate leading up to the war.
Yeah, those candidates who held their fire have really been harmed politically by it, because certainly that's not where the center of gravity is within the Democratic Party. So as a result, Dick Gephardt, the former House Minority Leader, did himself a tremendous amount of damage by organizing support for the Bush War Resolution. And Gephardt was very badly harmed by that. It turns out that John Kerry was also very badly harmed. Kerry was much more skeptical about the war and much more critical, but he did cast a vote in favor of the resolution, and that did him a lot of damage, especially in Iowa, which is a very anti-war state. In addition, of course, John Edwards and Joe Lieberman, who are actually quite supportive of the war to this day, particularly Lieberman, they virtually wrote themselves out of the contest. Then you start to look at the folks who've been much more critical of Bush. There's no question that Carol Moseley Brown and Al Sharpton have been very critical of the president. They haven't really mounted particularly effective campaigns so far, and they, frankly, and this is a sad measure, they haven't raised enough money. Among the candidates who have been critical and have done a little more in mounting a serious campaign, certainly Bob Graham of Florida has actually been very rough on the president. I don't think Graham has quite gelled it into an overall critique that works, but he's been very, very critical. Dennis Kucinich, the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, has probably had the most consistent critique of the president, not just on the war, but on domestic economic issues, regulatory issues, environmental issues, across the board. Kucinich's critique is by far the most, frankly, impressive from the standpoint of anyone who really is in opposition to Bush. Unfortunately for Kucinich, his campaign has been very poorly covered by the media and also has been somewhat dissed by Democratic activists who, for a variety of reasons, don't see him as the right messenger or the right horse in this race. And that brings us around to Howard Dean. Dean is not the most impressive critic of Bush. And he certainly doesn't have as consistent a critique as Kucinich does. And frankly, I don't even know that he has quite as much anger as Bob Graham does, or the humor that Al Sharpton brings. But Dean has combined a very steady, effective critique of the president with a lot of sophisticated campaigning and, frankly, a tremendous fundraising structure that has put him into a very good place. It's safe to say at this point that no one has surfed the anti-Bush sentiment quite so effectively as Howard Dean.
Now, just shortly after retired General Wesley Clark entered the race, he's on the top of the heap, at least some initial polls put him there.
Yeah.
But he's got a fairly ambiguous record on his support or opposition to the war in Iraq. He's been on both sides of the fence, so to speak, in interviews and what he's written.
Let's be clear about a couple of things. Number one, he is on the top of the heap, but he's not dramatically on the top of the heap. His public pronouncements about the war have been kind of surreally unfocused and going in a variety of different directions. In the first real interviews he did after announcing, to say that he would have voted for the resolution a year ago that authorized the war. And then, obviously recognizing that he'd made a bad mistake, the next day he gave a speech in which he said he would never, never have voted to go to war. But at the same time, he said he would have voted to give the president leverage, which translated meant he would have voted for the resolution. So this guy's been all over the place on the issue. And again, I think he actually ended up helping rather than hurting Howard Dean.
That was John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine. Read his articles in the pages of The Nation or online at www.thenation.com. In an echo of the freedom riders who risked their lives in the South during the 1960s struggle for civil rights, almost 1,000 immigrants boarded buses in 10 cities in late September, headed for New York City and Washington, D.C. The goal of the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, as it's called, is to raise awareness about the low wages, dangerous working conditions, and exploitation often encountered by immigrant workers. Groups supporting the Freedom Ride, who include labor unions, churches, and civil rights organizations, are also calling for the legalization of the country's estimated 8 to 10 million undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S. The buses will bring the immigrants and their supporters first to the nation's capital for meetings with congressional representatives before proceeding on to New York City for a major rally to be held October 4th at Flushing Meadows Park in the borough of Queens, home to one of the most ethnically diverse communities in America. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Glazer, national director of the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, who discusses the caravan, public attitudes towards immigrants after the September 11th terrorist attacks, and the stake the labor movement has in the future status of immigrant workers.
There are going to be three buses leaving Los Angeles, two buses leaving San Francisco, the Bay Area, one bus out of Portland, Oregon, another bus Seattle, Washington. Another bus will be leaving Las Vegas. There's buses leaving Minneapolis, Chicago, Boston, Miami, and Houston, Texas. I think at last count, there are 18 buses, so there are about 885 or so Freedom Riders that are going to be traveling across the country. We're going to be stopping in 93 different cities, towns, rural areas on our way to our three destinations, the main two being we're going to spend a couple days in Washington, D.C. We're going to stop off in New Jersey, and then it will culminate in New York City on October the 4th. So there's 106 different places involved. There's not much that we're missing in America.
It's not an accident that the title of this bus ride across the country is an echo of the Freedom Riders during the civil rights struggle of the 1960s. Tell us about the connection between this Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride and the civil rights struggle of that era.
There are a number of connections. One thing we don't do, though, is we don't say that the condition of immigrants today is the same as the condition of African Americans in the South in the 50s and 60s, nor that what we're going to be facing is similar to what they're facing. The viciousness of government enforcement of Jim Crow laws is different and just much more severe and difficult than what immigrants are facing today. Immigrants are facing a wide range of serious problems, but it's not equivalent. But certainly this movement is learning from the civil rights movement. We are asking Americans to look at American values that are being stepped on in the way that immigrants are treated in the country today. Let me give you an example. There are 7.5 million people who are documented immigrants with papers here who are entitled to become citizens, but in practice are barred from becoming citizens because of high fees, a bureaucracy that's understaffed and baffling, long lines, et cetera. So you've got 7.5 million people who are second-class citizens and are legally here, have documents. That's separate than the 8 to 10 million people who are here working, paying taxes, raising their families, who are undocumented. One out of nine people in America today were not born in America. So we are doing this massive mobilization, not to pass particular legislation at this time, but to say this is what's going on in America today, here our values are being stepped on, and that we all need to take a look at this and change immigration policy and change the laws. What you've got are, you've got millions of good people being punished by bad laws. So the Freedom Ride's goals are, one is to restore labor protections for immigrants on the way to restoring the right to organize for all workers, because the NLRB is so troubled, it's hard to join a union even when you want to. 50 million workers in poll data say that they would join a union if they could, but the laws are so twisted against unions, people can't. But our goals are to reward work and to legalize the 8 million undocumented, to revitalize democracy and have a practical way for the 7.5 million documented immigrants to become citizens and participate in civic life, to reunite families so that if, for example, you want to bring your son from the Philippines, you don't have to be on a 13-year waiting list. And fourth, to respect the civil liberties and civil rights of everybody. The Constitution talks about persons, not just about citizens, and an end to excessive arbitrary detentions, secret trials, etc.
Since the September 11th terrorist attacks, I think we can all reflect on the anti-immigrant fervor that we've seen in the public and certainly in legislation like the Patriot Act, which consciously targets immigrants. How has that contributed to the problems that immigrant workers face as they just try and go about making a living and feeding their families?
There have been hundreds of people who, because they had an a wrong Social Security number and didn't have documents, who've worked here for years, who've been deported back to Mexico or back to Guatemala. And hundreds of people have been deported without a single person having the slightest connection, not even an accusation of connection to terrorism. And what you're seeing, for example, in Arizona or in California this year, governors signing driver's license bills for people who don't have documents, is law enforcement is saying, state police and local municipalities are saying, if you drive people into the shadows further and further, we won't know what's happening in our communities. Crimes won't be reported, whether it be rape or murder or robbery. People won't go to the hospital if they're sick. And certainly the legitimate fight against terrorism can't be furthered if people are terrified to talk to the government. But we've certainly seen arbitrary detentions, secret detentions, massive roundups in secret. That's all, of course, coming out of 9/11. And we believe that the country needs to be kept safer and safe, but this administration's efforts have not particularly furthered that in many ways.
That was David Glazer, National Director of the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride. Contact the group organizing the Freedom Ride by calling area code 202-661-4204 or visit their website at www.iwfr.org. On September 19th, workers at Yale University overwhelmingly approved new contracts after a strike lasting more than 3 weeks. The 1,100 maintenance and dining hall workers, joined by almost 3,000 clerical and technical workers, won higher wages, better job security, another step on the advancement ladder, and maybe most importantly, a substantial increase in pension pay. The Yale Union's Locals 34 and 35 belong to HERE, the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union, whose president, John Wilhelm, a Yale graduate, began working for the union 35 years ago. He participated in negotiations at different points in the 19-month period after the last contract expired and the strike started on August 27th. But once it did start, he sat in on every meeting, going head-to-head with Yale President Rick Levin in talks mediated by New Haven Mayor John DeStefano. The strike was settled on September 19th. 3 days later, Wilhelm appeared at a news conference outside Yale New Haven Hospital with other labor leaders, elected officials, clergy, and hospital workers. They were there to push for fair contracts for the 150 dietary workers who are members of Local 1199, SEIU, and for a fair process to organize the other 1,700 service workers at the hospital. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Wilhelm about the unique aspects of the successful fight at Yale and the significance of this victory for the rest of the labor movement.
I think there's something very special going on here, and I think it ought to be celebrated. Locals 34 and 35 realized over the last decade that New Haven has become a company town, and the company is the university and its hospital. Years ago, when I first came to New Haven, there was large numbers of unionized manufacturing shops, large numbers of unionized shirt and apparel shops, and New Haven really had a three-legged economy, and there were a lot of good jobs available to ordinary working people, good union jobs. But all that industry is gone, all the manufacturing, all the shirts and apparel. And so the town has turned into a company town, and our unions came to the realization that in order to successfully advocate for the interests of workers in a company town, that we need to be part of a movement, and that movement has to be a movement not just in support of union issues, but a movement in support of the issues of all of the parts of the community. And so I think what we saw in the strike at the university over the last three and a half weeks and what we're going to continue to see in the struggle for justice at Yale New Haven Hospital is an extraordinary coalition, a coalition of the Locals 34 and 35, which is service and maintenance and clerical workers at Yale University, 1199, which is dietary workers at Yale New Haven Hospital and other hospital workers who seek to unionize, the graduate teachers and research assistants at Yale were such an enormous and important and vital part of the strike and part of this whole struggle, the community, the clergy, the elected leadership. We've seen all of the parts of this community come together really in an unprecedented way. And I've been in or around New Haven for almost 40 years, and it's a remarkable thing. And I think it's something that ought to be celebrated, and it's something that the labor movement, in order to be successful in advocating for workers, needs to do much more of around the country.
So this is a good model for a company town. But what about organizing workers in a town, in a city that has a lot of diversity still? What can those people in those struggles take from what succeeded here that might help them if it's a diverse economy and it's not really controlled by one or two employers?
I think the best reading of American labor history is that when the labor movement is part of a broad movement for social justice, that workers do better. And conversely, when we have a strong labor movement, our country does better. We sort of take for granted the existence of the American middle class, but the American middle class was literally invented by the labor movement. We take for granted that manufacturing jobs, which we're now losing by the millions because of globalization, we take for granted those are good jobs. Well, those were not good jobs until they became unionized in the 1930s and the 1940s. The manufacturing jobs used to be terrible jobs, just as most service sector jobs are today. So I think our country is stronger when we have a strong labor movement, and the labor movement is stronger when we reach out and form coalitions and support the issues that other people in the community have, and when we're part of a movement for justice. Our country is unique in the world. It's the largest country to which people came from everywhere else. Unless you're a Native American Indian, everybody and their family came from somewhere. That's what makes our country great. That's what's made our unions great. The backlash against the rights of immigrants after 9/11 is not in the interests of our country. 9/11 was not perpetrated by immigrants. Our union lost 43 members who worked on the Windows in the World restaurant on the top of the World Trade Center. Nobody feels more strongly against the people that perpetrated that criminal act than we do. But that act on 9/11 was not perpetrated by immigrants. It was perpetrated by criminals. And we need to celebrate the contribution of immigrants to this country. This country needs immigrants. We need to make sure that we don't engage in the hypocrisy of welcoming immigrants here to work and then denying them their rights. People who come here, work hard at jobs, pay taxes, join unions, join churches, build communities, revitalize cities, they should be honored.
That was John Wilhelm, president of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union. For more information on the labor struggle at Yale, call HERE at area code 203-624-5161 or visit their website at www.yaleunions.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Amika Toth. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Bill Cosentino, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.